Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. This is another edition of the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Today, we're being joined by a guest who hasn't been here with us for a while, but he's back, and he's got a fascinating new book coming out next year. Frank Joseph is the editor of Ancient American, a bi-monthly archaeology magazine, the author of 4 books, including Atlantis and Other Lost Worlds, and he's appeared on The Laura Lee Show, Fox's TV Strange Universe, lives in Minnesota, and he's been on Darkness Radio and Beyond the Darkness. He's back with us tonight to talk about his book, The Real War of the Worlds. Many of us remember when Orson Welles did the amazing radio documentary or radio show that scared everyone that heard it, believing that we were really being invaded by the Martians. And it was a fascinating way to kind of see the way culture would handle the possibility of UFO invasion or contact. And Frank Joseph is here with a book describing a real war of the worlds that took place almost a century ago. Frank, thanks so much for being here this evening.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's always a special pleasure being back with you. So I'm at your disposal for the next hour.
Well, I appreciate that. Let's dip into this. Now, there are so many books out there currently on UFO and UFO phenomena. How is the real War of the Worlds going to differ from all the thousands of other books out there on UFOs, Frank?
Yes, I can understand that. The idea came to me from my wife, Laura. She suggested that I write a UFO book. I completely resisted that. I don't have that kind of a background in ufology. I'm interested in the subject. I always have been, as millions of other people were. But she said, no, of all the books about UFOs, there's been no comprehensive military history of the UFO. She says, you've written all these military books and articles, and why don't you just approach the UFO problem entirely with military records? That's about the best documentation you could possibly hope for, and it might be something new. So I went on the internet and I found that there are a couple of books about the military relationship to the UFO question, but they're not comprehensive. They're mostly anecdotal. They're great books. But I approached it entirely from the point of view as a historian. If I was writing about World War II or something like that, some military engagements, and I started collecting information from, this huge amount of sources on the internet and published. But beyond that, I went into the military records, and I was really amazed at the huge amount of documentation that is stored in by our armed forces and the armed forces of the world. And what distinguishes a military report from any other kind is that when you're in the military, doesn't make any difference what country it is, if you file a military report, it must be factual. If there is anything in there that you have deliberately falsified or left out or misrepresented, you're going to be in big trouble. Those are felony charges. So when these guys would file these reports, they were under a very severe obligation to tell exactly what happened. And as a consequence, when eventually my book comes out, it won't be out till next year, next spring probably, but they'll be able to see that I have a pretty profuse source bibliography. I mean, everything that I write about in there is sourced, and these are military records. I think, like, my goodness, this provides a kind of a proof that I've not seen anyplace else. And the second thing, to answer your question, I don't want to belabor this too much, the second thing was that emerged from all this work is that I'm convinced that we, meaning the people of Earth, have been in a shooting war for a little more than 100 years now with these extraterrestrial intelligences. I think that the evidence is overwhelming. It's a real confrontation in which people have died, equipment has been destroyed, and it has been ongoing in spurts since 1916. And that's kind of a shocker. I think that there is a real possibility that this maybe it's not correct to call it a war. There's been no formal declaration. It certainly is secret. It's absolutely top secret. Nonetheless, it's happening. And is this a prelude to something that's going to happen in the future? I don't know. But there's no doubt that we have been in a firefight, an irregular firefight with a superior civilization for about 101 years now.
Now, somebody that's so fascinated in history and ancient cultures, lost cultures, do you find through the ancient records things that you would consider to be alien contact, UFO craft? I mean, there's a lot of talk about imagery that's seen in ancient history and ancient cultures and hieroglyphs. What do you make of that? Is that true in your estimation?
There is one document which I came across by accident, and this is one of the reasons why Laura asked me to go ahead with this book. Well, it must be 20 years ago I was in Egypt, and I was researching material at the Luxor Museum, which is in the south of Egypt, or what they call Upper Egypt. There's a terrific collection of source materials. They're translated into various languages. And I came across one called the Thule Papyrus. It was mentioned a period of time about 3,300 years ago that I was interested in at the time. And as I'm reading this, it's called the Thule Papyrus because the Italian translator who made it available about 70-some years ago has described an incredible mass sighting that took place in the kingdom of Amenhotep III, who was a very powerful, very brilliant pharaoh. It was during the Golden Age of Egypt. This is the New Kingdom. The report in the Thule Papyrus is not religious. It's not a poem. It's a straight military report. And this is what my book begins with. This is the earliest truly documented sighting of craft from another world. And it's a military report. Apparently what happened is that there was literally a fleet of these, what they describe as flaming discs in the sky that appeared over the Lower Nile Valley. This is more towards Cairo, was seen by at least hundreds of people. Pharaoh calls out his army. This is exactly what would happen today, calls out the military. There's no confrontation. There's no landing. But the sightings are unequivocal. These objects are low. They make no noise, just like is described today. They're soundless. And everybody's rather awestruck and rather terrified, but nothing happens, and eventually they just fly away. But that's the only... There's no mention of gods in this. There's no heavenly intervention, nothing like that. It's a straight military report. So that is the earliest... Actually, that is the earliest truly documented sighting. It's by a government, by a very powerful and wise government. And it's the military that's involved. So that's where it begins. Now, as regards other possible references that you mentioned, yeah, they do go back much further than that, but they're not as clear. We're not sure exactly what they might refer to. It's very interpretive. But the Thule Papyrus is not interpretive. It says what it says. It's very straightforward. And from that time on, I'm sure that these creatures or representatives of an off-world civilization were visiting here before. This is not the first, but it's the first documented one. And since that time, until 1916, there, of course, were numerous sightings all around the world, but there were no confrontations. There doesn't. I was unable to find any clear-cut documentation in which anybody was approached or injured or anything like that by these, what they call ETs. That changed radically with World War One. It was a huge shift. Before World War One, which of course began 1914, before 1914, it would appear that these objects or these creatures were just observing, just coming here, and this doesn't appear to be any other motivation for them. They were visitors, that's all. But from World War One on, there was a definite shift in attitude.
Well, and I'm curious, and we'll get into that. I want to start taking that part of the future. But I mean, it's so funny, right? I mean, here you found this papyrus, this information that had what is, I guess, technically the world's first military confrontation with these craft and seeing these things and first official report. Were you astounded to find that this report still existed, and B, to read this? I mean, what is that like the first time you read something like that for yourself and you realize that there is no other explanation for what they are witnessing in this kind of report back then?
Well, first of all, I thought, I was astounded, of course, and I thought it's perhaps there's a mistranslation here. I mean, the translation was excellent. It was done by an English archaeologist. The Thule Papyrus does not mostly deal with this. It mostly deals with normal bureaucratic things, and in this one section, it discusses this mass sighting. So when I got home, I did some further research on it, and I researched it as thoroughly as I could, and I found out it is a true, veritable report, and it was breathtaking. It was truly breathtaking, and I mentioned it to my wife, Laura, as I said, and years ago, and I said, boy, what are we to make of this? And I reread it several times, and it's just like reading a U.S. Air Force report, quite honestly.
Straightforward
language, yeah.
Does it make you reflect back on the work that you've done with ancient history and civilizations and see even that work in a different light now?
Absolutely, absolutely. It really gives you pause. I found out that was by no means the only report from the ancient world. It is the earliest, one of the best, one of the most thorough. But there are reports from Rome, which are excellent. Many terrific sightings. There was, as a matter of fact, the very first, I guess you can call it an interaction that took place. It's very well documented. This is about, about 100 A.D. There was a very great Roman general, Flavius is his first name. I can't remember his last name. I have it. Flavius Lavinius. That's it. General Flavius Lavinius. Very excellent general. And he had a confrontation with the Persians about 100-something A.D. And they were getting ready to duke it out. These two terrific armies were lined up. The Persians were very well commanded and equipped. It was going to be a really terrific battle. And just as this battle was about to begin, this has described... as a sphere appeared in the sky between the two armies, this luminous sphere, both armies panicked and withdrew, and no battle ever took place. Now, that might be considered alien intervention to stop slaughter. That's a possibility. But that is also a very well-documented, it's a very brief report. But Flavius Lavinius was no fool, and again, the report is not sensationalized. It's not like saying Jupiter came down and stopped the battle or anything.
Right.
Nothing like that. It's a straightforward report. So there are others, and to answer your question, yes, when you realize that this is real, that this is not just interpretive or fantasy, naturally it casts everything that you know. It's life-changing. It is truly life-changing because you have to conclude that there were other incidents that have inflected what you thought were the normal progression of history turns out to be something a little bit different. So, yes, it does definitely cast everything in a different light.
That's phenomenal. to uncover those kind of stories. And is it surprising to you that they're not more well known?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the things that I concluded from my research after I'd finished writing this book, and I was just in a passion to find out more about it. It became a real obsession, and because it was so eye-opening. One of the things I concluded, and I'm pretty sure of this, it's interpretive, I know, but the reason why there's so much secrecy surrounding UFOs and so much denial, and especially from the armed forces and the government and the news media trying to poo-poo it and portray people that are interested in it as lunatics and all that, is because the military, the U.S. military especially, but other militaries too, regard UFOs as their own private property. I can tell you for a fact that the U.S. government has been, government all the way up to the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, they knew about extraterrestrial craft in 1941, even before World War II, before the United States got World War II. I know for that for a fact, and I lay that information out. And ever since then, they've considered a secret. And the reason why is they regard UFOs as something to be harvested. This is advanced technology, far more advanced than anything on Earth. And whenever one of these things crashes, and they do from time to time, they're mostly shot down, by the way. When they are brought down, they're immediately seized by the military or the government authorities, because this is a great opportunity to achieve military superiority, military predominance on Earth. So this equipment is like ultra top secret as far as the government and the military is concerned. That's all they're interested in. So when they put all the secrecy and debunking and all that, their only real objective is that's we want that equipment, that's ours, and that's going to make us top dog on Earth. And they also know that some of this technology will overflow into our economy, like fiber optics. That fiber optics, you can trace that back directly to probably Roswell, the Roswell crash. But there have been other innovations, like microwave ovens and so forth. This is all, a lot of the stuff that we have today is back-engineered extraterrestrial technology that's seeped out from the military. They let some of it out, and they don't care to make a profit about it. They think it's great that the economy of the world, and especially America, benefits from this back engineering, but mostly they want the military hardware. They're trying to figure out, how do these things work? How do we apply this to our own military? So that's the mainspring of the secrecy involved in it.
All right. With that said, though, at the beginning of this, you said you started to do research into actual military files and reports. If it's so secretive, yeah, and they're so protective, how did Frank Joseph from Minnesota get access to legal binding reports from the government that pretty much clearly state what it is that's going on? It seems like that flies in the face of logic itself.
No, not really, because a lot of this material is declassified. It's not that ultra secret. And a lot of it is leaked out through the testimony of the military men that are involved. There have been a lot of these guys now, these aging warriors, as it were, all the way from Lance Corporal all the way up to these really high security clearance, like this one guy who was a sergeant, only a sergeant, but he was a very influential man in the U.S. Air Force back in the 1960s because he was kind of a technological genius, and so he was given a top-secret crypto clearance, which means he could go anywhere and do anything. Nobody could stop him. He had absolute top clearance because of his technical abilities. And these guys now that are aging, some of them are on their deathbeds, they're coming out with this material, which is made public. But it's just ignored. A lot of this material is not classified. And when it's declassified, it just sort of lays there. Like, who has ever heard, for example, of Operation Main Brace that took place in 1952? Even a lot of ufologists haven't heard of that. That stuff is totally declassified. A lot of it went public at 1952. And here you had literally hundreds, at least hundreds of servicemen who saw these flying saucers come flying out of the ocean. One of them collided with one of our ships, a destroyer. This is all highly documented. It's open. There's no secret involved. It just isn't discussed. You don't talk about it. And if you bring it out in public, unless you're on the Dave Schrader show, they say you're nuts. Or, oh, well, some people say this, some people say that, but the information is there. So a lot of stuff, although it's secret, it's really not secret so much as just ignored. It's not talked about. I found that in the case with a lot of history, by the way. Like if you look into the history of World War II, the true history of World War II, the declassified stuff, you'd be amazed what you come away with a completely different point of view than watching the History Channel. I mean, they leave out a huge amount of stuff. It's the same thing with UFOs. Now, there's no doubt that there's still a lot of classified stuff that I have no access to. But the stuff I had access to is no big deal. Anybody can get this stuff. A lot of it is on the Internet, and a lot of it is on not just the Internet, but it's on the U.S. Navy website. How about that? You can go on the U.S. Navy website.
That's what I was going to say. If you're talking about it being information that's available on the Internet,
yeah,
how do we know then that it's sourced and it's legitimate information? Because there's so many people that are very proficient at creating fake documents to look like real documents. How do you start to sort them out? Are you able to trace, okay, there's a file number here, and if I go to the Hall of Records, I can see that this file number does fit in and it's missing, or okay?
No, that's absolutely correct. You have to do that with each individual document. And I have traced down some things that look really good that turn out to be absolutely fake. I don't know who's putting that out, what kind of disinformation is that, and I hope I've been able to keep as much of that disinformation out of my book as possible. But when I would come across a report or a description of something, feel that's really cool, and before I would include it in the book, I would source it as much as I possibly could. And you have to make a determination on that. Sometimes I'll put things in there that I will admit that I'm not entirely sure if this is correct. But I think that the stuff is legit because if you can trace it back to the original sources, they're open to the public and you can get them, but they're just not talked about.
Well, let's go back and talk about when they really start to interact. We talked about the fact that they'd been seen throughout history without really doing anything, but at the advent of World War I, suddenly there's this uptick in activity. Do you believe that's because suddenly, you know, the hairless apes have figured out how to master the sky in World War I, and now they've become an interesting race to watch?
That's it. Well, the moment that you could take, you could have explosives and drop them from the air, I mean, the extraterrestrials aren't fools, and they can see that an interpolation of history will show that if they can fly a biplane that's going maybe 100 miles an hour and drops a 50-pound bomb, given these creatures, in other words, us, enough time, it's only a matter of time before we're able to do something far more dramatic and go into space and become a threat. The real mystery to me, Dave, is why they haven't wiped us out. I mean, how come they haven't had a preemptive strike, because it's only a matter of time. I mean, the next, 100 years or so, which is nothing, before we've already weaponized space. We already have the capability to put atomic weapons in space and beyond the moon. So why they haven't wiped us out, why they haven't come down and prevented it from becoming too much of a threat, I don't know.
Well, especially when we're shooting them down. Because especially because we're shooting them down.
We can shoot them down, right?
Right. So you would think that would make them.
How is that possible? These advanced weapons, you know, there are systems that they have. How is it that our crummy little jet planes, which can't even go outside the atmosphere, can shoot these things down? Well, it's the same thing. Like there was a movie you may have been familiar with. It's called Apocalypse Now. Is that it? Yeah, because Francis Ford Coppola.
Right.
And there's a scene in there where this guy is on a patrol boat in Vietnam and has all these modern electronics and machine guns and everything else, and they get attacked by these primitive people on the shore, and this guy gets hit in the chest with a spear, and he dies. As he's dying, he says, "A spear." In other words, here he's the master of all this terrific 20th century technology, and some dude on the shore with an accurate throw was able to kill him with a spear. That's the same thing, too. If you go in the jungle and you run up against some of these primitive people that are willing to, shoot a blowgun at you or something, we're a dangerous species.
Right.
So it happens. Yeah, it happens. So that's my big mystery. I can't imagine. I mean, if I was in their shoes, I would, want to do something. Now, they have done things from time to time that have really told us that we're not supposed to be doing what we're doing. There are several occasions, both in the United States, very well documented, both in the United States and in the Soviet Union, in which nuclear facilities have been shut down by ETs. Now, that's pretty well known, and that fact alone, I think they're trying to tell us, don't use these things.
Well, let's talk
about World War I was the turning point, because that was when we could finally get powerful weapons, relatively powerful weapons, into the skies.
Now, there's been reports, Frank, and a couple of different books have mentioned this, and I was wondering if you were able to find any corroborating data that Baron von Richthofen, the Red Baron, reportedly shot down one of these craft as well. Were you able to find anything to substantiate that claim?
Yes, I did. Quite a bit, actually. I go into that at some detail. I was hesitant to do so because that report came out in a very dubious tabloid. And so I thought, oh, my God, this is just some silly story, But when I looked into it, I found that the pilot involved really did exist. His name was Wasrick. He was a very obscure pilot. He never achieved much of a during the war, but he was a student pilot. I found out that he was a cadet in von Richthofen's squadron, and that he describes in his article, Wasrick, that he and Baron von Richthofen, just the two of them, went out at dawn on a sort of a patrol mission. Well, as it turns out, von Richthofen used to always do that. You would think a guy of that prestige wouldn't bother about cadets, but he would take new guys and personally bring them out over the lines to show them the ropes and show. He did that all the time. So that was an interesting indication that this sounded kind of real. Of course, somebody could have read that elsewhere and put that in there. But I found that von Richthofen's there were a lot of things wrong with the article. They said it was a Fokker triplane, a red triplane. It was not correct. That aircraft had not been even released at the time that this incident took place. He was flying instead something called a Halberstadt, which was a biplane. And, but it checked out to the point where it seemed credible. I'm not absolutely sure that it did happen. But the story is that in March of 1917, Wasrick was being taken out over Flanders, or the Hindenburg line at that time. It was known. Von Richthofen was showing him the ropes at a dawn patrol. All of a sudden, a large disc appeared directly in front of them. Von Richthofen's animal instinct kicked in. He fired his machine gun, and this thing crashed. I mean, the whole incident took place within a nanosecond, just about. And the thing crashed and fell to the earth. And in the article, the Baron went back, landed back at his base, and filed a report that this was some kind of he described it as an unknown Allied aircraft, some kind of secret machine. There was never any discussion this thing was a UFO or from another world, and they assumed immediately that it was some kind of a spirit technology that the British or the French were operating, and the Germans swore him to secrecy, Wasrick to secrecy, because this was a top secret weapon that the enemy was using. So a lot of things fit. I'm not sure that it absolutely happened, but I put it in because I think it's credible. I think, to be perfectly honest with you, I think it's about 60-40 percent that it was real. I tend to agree that it was real. But the documentation is not that solid, but the circumstantial evidence is pretty convincing. So I think it probably did happen. That was not the first confrontation between human beings and extraterrestrials. And the ones that happened the year before are extremely well documented, far better documented than this. And this took place in the United States, which was neutral at that time. In 1916, the United States was becoming the world's supplier of munitions. And the big supplier of munitions was DuPont. DuPont had these munitions factories all across the United States, mostly in New Jersey, but in other parts of the United States as well. And throughout the early part of 1916, a number of these munitions plants and factories exploded. Well, naturally, people think, well, back in those days, their safety precautions weren't that good, and so you had these explosions that took place. That might have been the case in some of these, and very few, actually, because DuPont was a stickler for security, and they had some really high, surprisingly high standards to ensure safety at these plants. Nonetheless, it's possible that a number of these plants exploded because of accidents or whatever. You've got thousands of men working there and somebody made a mistake. However, a lot of these, a large percentage of these munitions plants that were demolished, at the time that they were demolished or just before they exploded, there were UFO sightings directly over them or in their immediate vicinity. It was a time also of peculiar fires that broke out in their vicinity. And I think that the documentation for this is, I didn't do the documentation for this, I quote it mostly from an Englishman by the name of Williamson, who did some really great work on that. And that there's a string of munitions from about February 1916 to about May, a very short space of time. These munitions plants appear to have been destroyed by the intervention of these flying discs that were seen immediately before or afterwards. And I think that was the beginning of the intervention by extraterrestrials in earthly affairs. You extend that from 1916 to the end of the 20th century, where you see them now interfering in atomic power plants. And those are even better documented. The thing about, to get back to von Richthofen, one thing that comes to mind, there was a really well-documented, better-documented confrontation at that same time, the same month that von Richthofen supposedly shot down this UFO, March 1917, again in America. And this was at the Portsmouth Shipworks, if I remember, Portsmouth or Plymouth Shipworks on the East Coast. And there were four guardsmen who opened fire on a disc that appeared just in that same month. So that is one of the earliest firefights, if you want to call it that, or responses from the American military documented. That's very well documented source. So I see that 1916, 1917, that is the year in which the ETs, if you want to refer to them as that, were no longer mere observers, but now were involved in inhibiting American, or rather, first American and then later European military affairs.
That's astounding that they were there during all of these weird encounters. And it seems, you know, we've talked about it on and off through our show for years, that, like you said, most of the time it seemed like they may have been observers. All they were doing was looking for, you know, information. Were they just there to witness? Were they there to watch? I've often wondered if really those are time travelers, us from the future, sent to, you know, investigate history and find the real story of what took place at these historic points. Because look at all of the amazing places that these alien craft show up, and at those specific times in history. That seems really interesting to me, especially with the way history is, you know, recounted.
And it's interesting, like, perhaps they want to change the past, their past, and that's why they intervene. Dr. Alan J. Hynek, of course, was very well known regarding this problem back in the 1950s and 60s. He said that he would be very disappointed if he found out that the extraterrestrials only came from another planet. What he meant by that is that he came to the conclusion that these beings are either from another dimension, parallel universe, which now mainstream science accepts, or else sometime in the future. That, in other words, the aliens are us. And I've always kind of inclined towards that. I don't mention that in the book because that's just speculation. But I agree with you, because these beings are described as humanoid. They're not that much physically different than us. So I'm under the impression that these are our descendants who are able to master time, and they're coming back here to prevent the development of things the way they turned out. That's the way it strikes me, but that's just my speculation at this point.
No, that makes a lot more sense to me almost than extraterrestrial craft, you know, from other planets. Not saying that they wouldn't be here, but you would think that, you know, historians would, much like animal activists, right? They will go out and lay in the tall grass with the lions or the gorillas, and they get into their pride, knowing full well that this kind of research could lead to their death. So
yeah,
there can be no retaliation if they come up dead.
Oh, uh-huh.
Right? So if they're really observers
that's
here for that.
That's convincing.
That would make sense to me, because you would think if they were really alien craft in nature who've come all the way here and they have that kind of superiority, you shoot one down, there's going to be a firefight. There's going to be full strength showing you what is coming your way.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that would be much more of a probability.
Well, I think that's a very great analogy, Dave, and it's certainly given me a little bit more food for thought, too. This is not to say that the extraterrestrials have not returned fire. They have, and they have killed human beings. There have been instances where there's been deaths on both sides, no doubt about it.
We're going to take a break. We'll come back. Let's get into those confrontations with the real War of the Worlds. Frank Joseph, our guest, right here on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from
beyond the darkness.
The Real War of the Worlds. Frank Joseph, our guest today, as we talk about strange and frightening military encounters, real records of UFO confrontation, and in this segment of the show, we're going to talk more about the aggressive nature. We've talked about the observing nature of a lot of the craft that have been seen through time. When does it start to step up, Frank, where combat begins, not just us firing at them, but maybe them retaliating or even beginning these battles?
World War II. World War I, there was the destruction of DuPont's munitions factories. Nobody was killed in any of these things, which is kind of interesting, isn't it? Because these explosions were huge.
Right.
They resulted in many millions of dollars worth of property destroyed and very destructive, but nobody was killed. I think there were a few injuries, that's about all. That's World War I. And then the aerial confrontation von Richthofen and Wasserick had, nobody was hurt. In the beginning of World War II, there were things known as Foo Fighters that were seen by the United States and the RAF pilots. And these were very bizarre lights that would appear, and sometimes they'd appear very close to the aircraft. The aircraft would fire at them, had no effect on them at all. But there were no losses until 1942. In 1942, there was a flight of B-17s headed towards Germany, the Ruhr region, and some of these Foo Fighters were seen, and they always were reported. And their reports were received with mixed feelings by their superiors. Some of their superiors said, "Well, you're just seeing glare or reflection in your cockpit, the plexiglass or something. There's nothing like that." And others said, "Oh, these are German super weapons," and so on. Of course, the Germans were seeing the same thing and thought that they were American super weapons, you know. And the Japanese saw them, too. They thought, "Oh, these are Allied things," you know. So people on both sides were seeing these objects, and they knew they were not theirs. But 1942, this was late, this was October 1942, there was a mission of B-17s on the way to the Ruhr, and some Foo Fighters were seen overhead. They were not even all that rare. I mean, they were uncommon, but many men had seen them. And this one particular Foo Fighter, as they called it, made a relatively low pass. It dropped some kind of sprinkling material that glittered through the air. The glittering material landed on the B-17. The B-17 lost both of its wings, burst into flames, and was destroyed with the loss of all hands. And that was an absolute, that was a real attack to destroy that particular aircraft. And there were others involved. Again, it didn't make any difference whether they were Allied or Axis. Towards the end of World War II, in February 1945, two or four, I'm not quite sure, it's not sure, two or four Japanese Zeros were involved in a real dogfight with some of these objects, and all of the Japanese aircraft, of course, were destroyed with total loss of life. About two or four men were killed there. Now, the loss of life during World War II was low, admittedly. It was just in groups of maybe on board the B-17, that'd be about like seven or eight men. And the Japanese lost two or four in 1945, and there were a few others before then. But nonetheless, that showed a real shift. There was a real difference going on. The Russians even reported, during World War II, Stalin's men reported firing artillery at objects that they thought were German balloons. And that this is this one thing where a very large silver object appears on the Eastern Front, and the Russians thought that the Germans are having a counteroffensive of some kind, so that all their massed artillery opened up on this thing, had no effect on it whatsoever, and it just leisurely went away. They thought it was some kind of an armored balloon. As turns out, the Germans weren't even in that area. They had evacuated that area the day before. So there are peculiar things like that. But that marks the real turning point. Then afterwards, there were some things incrementally got worse over time, and so by the time of the Vietnam War, there were some extremely disturbing confrontations, the most disturbing so far. There's something that's fairly well known. It's called the Grudge Report. It's public information. I checked this out as best I possibly could because the allegations in it were pretty horrific. There was this one operator who's cited in the Grudge Report. He was, and I checked him out, he was a real person. He did what he was supposed to do. He was a special operative in Vietnam. Therefore, he and his teams would go in to rescue crews of downed aircraft in enemy territory in the jungles of Vietnam. Now, this B-52 had gone missing in this one area. And B-52, of course, is this huge Stratofortress, giant bomber. And they found the bomber, no problem, and they were amazed because when these planes crash, there's virtually nothing of them left. Just the debris field is just atomized, just teeny little fragments. Here the B-52 was in relatively good shape. It was busted up, but the wings were still on it, and it looked as though it had just somehow drifted into the jungle. And so they approached, they thought it might be booby-trapped, and the Grudge Report states that when they got into the aircraft, they found that all the crew had were still aboard, they were all dead, and they had been severely mutilated. Some of their organs had been removed and so forth. There's another report, complimentary of that, in which a man that was running one of these patrol boats down the rivers in the Mekong Delta had heard stories from his fellow from his predecessors there that at least a couple of Americans had been found very badly mutilated, and they attributed it to the Viet Cong. It turns out that both of these men had been retrieved from an area where the Viet Cong never were, and so he eventually found out that there were other instances like this of severe mutilation. The worst story of that kind was of a Sergeant Lovett who was kind of abducted, I suppose, temporarily abducted. He was on sort of a border patrol, had an atomic missile facility with a lieutenant. Lovett was a sergeant, and the lieutenant's name I can't recall offhand. And so Sergeant Lovett was abducted, and they found his body. It was severely mutilated also. A number of organs had been removed. So there have been some very unpleasant things. What's interesting about the Grudge report, it was not sensationalized. I had to dig this out. I found that the only reference to this mutilation on board the B-52 was in a Canadian radio broadcast on a small radio station back in the 1970s. I got the transcripts of that. And there are some pretty rough things.
That was such a unique time, too, though. I mean, they were very careful with the information that they let out. I know there was a lot of redacted information during the Vietnam War and such. Were you surprised, again, to see a full transcription from this actual account? And was much of it redacted or blacked out?
No. I wasn't really surprised, because by that time in my research, I found that this information is really pretty available. You have to dig for it, but it's just this mostly, as I say, mostly neglected or just not discussed, rather than classified or declassified. A number of these were classified for a number of years, and when they were declassified, nobody took much information, much notice of it. But to answer your question originally, there is this escalation of hostilities gradually over time. Another example of that is a terrific investigator, Paul Stonehill, the name you might be familiar with. He's done some really fabulous work on Russian reports. And he also mentioned, too, that there were a few indications where Soviet troops had been brutalized. He mentions the greatest number of fatalities involved in a single confrontation between Earth forces and off-world intruders, if you want to call it that. And that was a couple of dozen cadets. They were in training in Siberia, and an object appeared. And the Soviets, by that time, this is about 1963, the Soviets had and this was a CIA report, which has been declassified, but nobody looks at it, but it's a CIA report. And so they were in training in Siberia in October 1963, and they were in training. By that time, the Soviets had fully acknowledged amongst themselves that UFOs were real, and they put out an order to all of their troops, all of their officers, that under no circumstances are these objects to be fired upon. It's absolutely forbidden, just to be avoided. The only time you fire on them is if you're in a situation where they're firing at you, but that rarely ever happens, if at all. Well, one of the troops apparently panicked, and he fired a service-to-air missile, one of these shoulder missiles, at the object, hit the object, knocked it down. The object crashed. Some beings got out and killed all of them except two. There's about two dozen men. We don't know exactly how many. It's about 24, 25 men were killed instantly, and two survived by hiding. We don't have any word in the report what became of the craft or the aliens, but that's the largest documented one. Stonehill talks about another case in which almost as many Soviet pilots were killed. They got into this is years before, it's 1956. They got into a dogfight with a number of these craft. That's a big mistake, and they were all killed. That's about two dozen airmen.
See, this this should be much more publicized, and I understand maybe why the government doesn't talk about this, because if they do engage and decide to fight us, they seem pretty capable of just wiping us out without much cause.
The only time, apparently, that we can wipe them out, we knock them down, is when we take them by surprise. We ambush them because they are sentient beings, and you know they're not omniscient, I don't think. And so if their attention, like for example, von Richthofen, how is it possible that von Richthofen finding this spindly little biplane that could only go 100 miles an hour knocks down this craft from another world or another time dimension, and it would appear that this craft had no idea that he was there. That the occupants of this craft in March 1917 were looking at things on the ground. They were watching the war take place on the ground. Their attention was elsewhere. And so he shot them down because they didn't even know he was there. And there are other instances like that where the Americans can... Actually, there was a time when the Secretary of Defense, Vincent Forrestal, set a trap for them and knocked them down with a burst of microwave energy. So that was a kind of an ambush, too. But if it's in a situation where they know where you are, the chances of you scoring against them are low to non-existent. But if you take them by surprise, or they don't know what's happening, then you can get an advantage on them. But it's a very fleeting advantage. And like I say, there have been instances where we have shot them down. One of the most recent instances was in 1994. Oh, this is a terrific story that was told by Lance Corporal, where in Peru, we the United States gave the surface-to-air missile batteries to the Peruvians who were having trouble with drug smugglers, flying these planes, these drug planes, and from Bolivia and so forth. And so they mistook, apparently, one of these planes, these drug planes, for a UFO for one of these drug planes, and they shot the thing down and with one of these things. And he went and he saw it. He was with it for about 10 or 15 minutes before these guys in hazmat suits came and took him out of the area. But he had been assigned in March 1994, to investigate this, what they thought was a drug plane that had been shot down. He had been assigned from Texas. He was with the U.S. He was with the Marine Corps. He was kind of like a guard, really. Let's say he was just a Lance Corporal. And so he was sent out into the Peruvian jungle with about 30 other guys to get this some drug plane. And instead of plane there, they see this very bizarre teardrop-shaped oval craft smashed on the ground. And he said it had all the blast effects of these Hawk surface-to-air missiles, which we had been giving to the Peruvians. So, yeah, they are shot down from time to time. Mostly, though, when there's it is interesting that when there are mostly confrontations, the UFOs like to play cat and mouse. They'll be like right in your gun sights, you're ready to go, your fingers on the trigger, and they'll vanish, or they'll make a right angle turn at 2,000 miles an hour or something like that. So there are a lot of these dogfights are feints. All the way back to the 1950s, there's a famous Gorman dogfight in which this guy got into a real dogfight with he was flying a P-51 Mustang, and he got into a real dogfight with a UFO, and there was he couldn't get a bead on it. It never got it, and the UFO just ran circles around him. That's all. Eventually took off. So there are quite a few like that, but there are others that are far more serious in which We do shoot them down. There have also been a number of abductions, which are really horrific. First Lieutenant Mokla and his observer flying a F-89 Starfire over Lake Superior.
Mm-hmm.
They went up to investigate. They were ordered to investigate a large unidentifiable craft that had been picked up on radar. And on radar, they could follow the blip of Mokla Starfire and the UFO, and they merged, and the UFO took off, and that was the end of the craft. The craft was not a shred of debris was ever found, or any trace of those two men. There have been others like that, where they have abducted the pilots and the whole aircraft all together. There have been several instances like that. Again, not just in the United States. Soviet reports have been exactly the same.
And we talked about the UFO and kind of the sky superiority, but you mentioned earlier about these craft that were underwater that burst forth.
Oh, yeah.
USOs, unidentified submersible yes. objects. What can you tell us? And we shared a story about that not too long ago on our show, and we've heard it. My son was stationed on the Reagan and as a Navy sailor, and during watch one night, he and his commanding officer allegedly witnessed something under the water and then come up and take off. And he was just told, we saw nothing. We have nothing to report. And that was the end of the story. But it really freaked my son out. Not in a bad way, but it was just like a whole new consciousness shift to see something like that.
That's right. That's exactly a whole new consciousness shift. That's right. Exactly what it is. It's life changing. Well, the first, as far as I can understand, the first military documentation of a USO, under unidentified submerged object, was again World War II, at the end of World War II. And that was observed. They thought it was some kind of a gigantic turtle at first. You know, it's an interesting thing that when these guys see these things, they never think that these are UFOs or unreached off and all the rest of it. They never think these are from another planet. They always assume it's either some kind of a bizarre animal or it's the enemy technology. And it's only years later that it eventually dawns on, like, oh, my gosh, maybe that was something else that was seen in World War II that was just observed. But the best documentation for USOs I've ever come across is in Operation Main Brace, or actually Exercise Main Brace. This was the largest Allied naval exercise after World War II. It was in September 1952, and it involved the navies of nine different nations, and it was led by the USS Franklin D. Roosevelt, which was a pretty new aircraft carrier. And that is important because the Franklin Roosevelt was the first warship in history to be fully equipped with nuclear weapons. And this fact alone seemed to have attracted no less than seven or eight major sightings during Exercise Main Brace, which lasted about a week or so, seen by hundreds and hundreds of sailors. And the outstanding event was when two destroyers on the periphery of Main Brace, in other words, far from the Franklin Roosevelt, were doing patrol. And as they were patrolling, their sonar on that, both of these destroyers registered the same object under the water, not particularly deep, about 100 feet. And the thing that they couldn't understand were two things. One, that this object was a solid object. They thought it was a submarine at first, Soviet submarine. That the object was keeping pace with the destroyers. Now, that is, the destroyers are going like 40 or miles an hour. They're going like about, 45 knots. There's no submarine in 1952 that could go that speed. And the other thing that was amazing is that the object was a quarter of a mile in diameter.
Holy
It's a quarter
cow.
Of a mile wide. Anyway, they're tracking this thing.
What the hell,
when it springs out of the water.
Okay.
And when it springs out of the water, it dings, as the guy's name was Jordan, who was one of the men that was serving on the Franklin Roosevelt at the time, it dinged, had a slight collision, caused minor damage with the stern of one of the destroyers, shoots up into the air, and disappears within a second or so. And this object was photographed by a guy that was on the Franklin Roosevelt, because when this thing shot out of the water, it made a beeline for the Franklin Roosevelt. And when it appeared over the Franklin Roosevelt, like about 2 seconds later, it was seen by everybody on the flight deck, it was seen by everybody on the bridge, and was photographed by one of the journalists who was along to document Operation Main Brace. Yeah, it's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, it is.
Now, nobody, there were no shots fired, nobody was hurt. But talk about USOs, and the Danish Navy had a superb sighting that was that made the Associated Press. That's terrific stuff.
That is that's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
Right,
a quarter of a mile across. But Jordan, this guy who was a this Jordan that I'm talking about. He was no slouch. He was in charge of the radar one of the men in charge of the radar on the Franklin Roosevelt, and that was the most advanced communications electronic communications in the world at that time. So this guy was highly qualified, and he was saying, the object was a quarter of a mile across. He says it twice. Once he says, it was a quarter of a mile across. And he says it again, a quarter of a mile in diameter. But there are bigger ones than that. That's not the biggest one. There have been others that have been seen much bigger, much larger than this. Others that are much smaller. Well, we have all kinds of aircraft. Why can't they have all kinds of spacecraft?
I guess. Boy, the idea that, you know, I mean, we're not alone. That's not anything dramatic. But to realize that this is all going on around us, that there are different governments talking about this. Have you been able to follow a story that crosses governmental planes? Like, you know, it started off in the United States, and then Canada started tracking this craft and had an encounter, or Russia. Has any of that happened that you're able to kind of see it's a corroboration of stories between multicultures?
Well, yes, I have, Dave. There's been instances of sightings that have been picked up from one country to the next. In my book, The Real War of the Worlds, I have tried pretty much to stay away just from sightings alone. I wanted to emphasize interactions, actual engagements that took place. There are a number of sightings, military sightings that I put in there, but for the most part, I wanted to show that this is an actual military situation going on. If it's not a war, it's like a pre-war or a phony war or a secret war or something like that. So that's been my main emphasis. But there have been instances where, yes, they've been picked up from one to the other. And what's interesting, in one case, the Americans picked up what they couldn't imagine what this thing was. It was at 80. This is back about 1960. They picked up an object, a fairly large object, at 80,000 feet. Well, there was no aircraft in the world in the 1960s that could fly at 80,000 feet, especially at some ridiculously high speed, you know, 2,000 miles an hour. Thought it was a meteor or something, but then it was approaching the United States in a zigzag pattern. So anybody aboard that craft would have been turned to butter with those G-forces. And then it passed over, and the Soviets picked it up, and they thought it was an American ICBM of some kind. This misidentification has been going on since World War One. Every time these things are seen, the military reaction is always, oh, it's one of theirs, and they've got some secret technology. Then they realize, yeah, it's secret technology, it's high technology, and we want it. And that's the main spring behind the secrecy involved, is that if a UFO crashes on your lawn, the military is going to be there, and they're going to say, you saw nothing. And if you do anything about it, you know, you and your family are toast. And they do that not because, you know, they're afraid of social dislocation or anything like that, or people are going to run wild in the streets. They don't care about that. They only care about that technology hardware they want to get their hands on. That's all they care about.
That's pretty remarkable. A lot of these craft seem to be seen over different military installations or close to military installations, which again seems to me either like they're taunting us, or it really
sometimes
leads you to want to believe that they are our craft, that they're something from us, either again from now or the future, and they're just checking in, and that's why they're able to be around these military installations without, you know, kind of retaliation.
Well, that's kind of it. Well, like I said, there has been retaliation sometimes, instances, but generally speaking, no.
But like you said, some of these might be different races or different beings that we don't have connection with. And if, you know,
that's correct,
those are the ones we engage with. But there's a lot of places around the world that are UFO hotspots, and they're very close to nuclear facilities, military installations and bases. And there's,
oh yeah,
and they're happening all the time. And there's not these Black Hawk, you know, helicopters or screaming jets chasing them. So it feels like almost like they have permission to be in some of these areas.
Well, I don't know if they have permission. Usually, when things like that happen, the people in the Air Force base, they're just like human beings everywhere. They're traumatized. They're like frozen. You know, you see something just show up like that. It's like, oh well, we have to do this or that, or protocol demands we do this. Usually the reaction is human. People just freeze when they see this stuff. But I wonder about their agendas, because one of the most disturbing instances involved, you talk about multinational, transnational contacts.
Right.
Well, there was this one instance in which it was at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. in which a UFO appeared and set in motion a launch sequence for a nuclear-tipped missile aimed at the Soviet Union. And it was only at the last conceivable moment that the Americans were able to shut this thing down. It was, we were within seconds, probably not a minute, of launching a nuclear-tipped missile at the Soviet Union. The same thing happened in Russia, exactly the same thing, except that the Soviets could not stop their sequence. They had a number of missiles aimed at the United States that were the sequence to launch had been initiated. The Soviets could not shut it down. They got on their own hotline to Moscow saying, we cannot stop this thing, and it stopped by itself. They had no control. We had control over that situation at the very last moment. So there are... These were two instances in which it appeared very much so that the ETs were trying to start a nuclear war, trying to start a nuclear exchange. Either that or it was a joke that was lost on us. It didn't happen in Russia because it got shut down automatically, or who knows how that stopped. In the United States, it got shut down because the technicians were able to shut it down within seconds before that missile would have been launched. And it, in both cases, they were precipitated by the appearance of large glowing spheres. Now, maybe there were more instances like that, but I know that at least in those two instances, we came close to a nuclear exchange because of extraterrestrial intervention.
Yeah, now that's scary.
Pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, that is very scary. And then the ones when they've just been able to come in and shut everything down. Power.
That's what they do mostly.
Missile silos.
They shut the power down. Yeah.
You would think.
In one instance, they actually, in Malmstrom Air Force Base, they actually disabled the missiles. The missiles were wrecked. They fried them. They had to be replaced.
That's unbelievable. Yeah, I was just going to say, have they ever affected the missiles or the locations to where there was an issue?
You bet. You know, what's really bizarre, too, is that the earliest nuclear power plants, research facilities, back in 1945, like at Hanford in Washington, that's where the plutonium bombs were being built for Nagasaki. Those places were the most secret places on Earth, maybe only a couple dozen people even knew they existed. The people that worked there had no idea what they were doing. Everything was so compartmentalized. It was ultra secret. And yet the moment that the Hanford plant began processing plutonium, the UFOs showed up. They didn't do anything, but they were there. How did they know?
Right.
How did they know that? But they were there. When the plutonium processing began in February 1945, that's when these objects showed up. So they've been following closely, very closely, U.S. and Soviet nuclear developments. I shouldn't even say that, because all over France there have been nuclear power plants that have been visited by these objects. In Slovenia, there's a small power plant that was visited, I think, about 2 years ago. An object was seen hovering above a power plant there. So they're very much concerned about our nuclear capabilities, and especially if we bring nuclear capabilities into space. I mean, if I was them, I'd want to have some kind of a preventative measure. I mean, we are a very dangerous species.
Extremely. Yes, we are.
We are a destructive, exploitative. We always have been. It's our nature. And to have a species like this with atomic weapons in space, I think that we're very, very dangerous.
Yeah, I would agree. They would have to keep a little tighter rein. But that's what you think by now. If they're showing us that they have the capabilities to come shut this stuff down, why aren't they doing that? And it does make you wonder, with these test shots that North Korea keeps doing that seem to fail, one right after the other, you wonder if maybe there is some kind of intervention going on, and they're like, nope, not going to let you do it, and they keep tanking the missiles.
Well, you've heard of a man called Elon Musk?
Right. Elon Musk, right?
Elon Musk.
Yes.
He had something called Falcon 9, and the Falcon 9 was this carrier that was supposed to be able to put much heavier freight into orbit, including nuclear weapons. It didn't, but it had the possibility, that capability. And Falcon 9 exploded as it was about to take off. It was totally destroyed. And Elon Musk himself said that it's possible that a UFO destroyed it. Now, you can go on YouTube for this. And I talk about declassified or stuff that's available. You can go on YouTube and you can look at the Falcon 9. I urge all of our listeners to go on YouTube and look at the Falcon 9 explosion. And you will see this disc go flying around at incredible speed, very fast. And you can put a stop on it and you can see it. This thing is zipping around it just as it's fueling up, as it's getting ready to go. And all of a sudden, this thing makes a close pass. You can't miss it. And the thing explodes, totally destroyed. And then Elon Musk himself says, I don't understand why this thing exploded. We had all this investment. It really set back our program, blah, blah, blah. We don't know what it is. And we're looking at the possibilities of a UFO. Well, I don't see how you could avoid it, because if you go on YouTube and you see all of a sudden this little dot comes flying in really fast from one side, and it comes flying in fast from the other side. That makes a close pass towards the apex of the missile, and the missile explodes. Pretty interesting. And if you can say, there it is. So I think that they've done stuff like this. There's so much. There's so much
Do you ever, when you do this kind of research, I mean, you're used to doing the history and dead lands and dead cultures. When you realize just what's going on with this book, is there any part of you that's like, man, I really didn't need to know this?
Well, it's not what I expected at all. It's not what I expected. I thought I'd just have an interesting history, a military history. What do the military say? And you know, nothing would come of it. I mean, it would be an interesting collection. But instead, I've been able to chronicle a progressive situation, and I don't know where it's leading. It's disturbing. It's very disturbing. I got to when I started writing the book, I knew that these things existed. I thought, yeah, there are a lot of credible people, and I think anyone that takes an unbiased look at this problem has to conclude that there's something to it, especially when you have so many credible witnesses. But when you see this much documentation piled so high, and then a story begins to emerge, and themes and patterns, it's kind of life-changing. It's disturbing. And I'm powerless. We're all utterly powerless. There's nothing we can do about it. And I don't know where it's going to lead. The book sort of ends at loose ends because I can't tell the reader where this is going. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, hopefully it all ends with a lot of hand-holding and hugging and kissing with alien races, and we're all safe.
Oh.
Hey, a guy can dream, Frank. A guy can dream.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, look at ourselves. If we go to a very materially advanced culture, what has been our history so far when our culture, a sophisticated thing like Western civilization, meets up with less developed cultures, we destroy them one way or another. And maybe that's, I don't know. I don't want to say that we're going to be destroyed. I'm not a pessimist on this. But quite honestly, if it was up to me, I hope we'd never go into space. Because I hope we'd never go. Well, I think I would like to see the Earth developed, and let's take good care of the Earth. But I think we can explore space. We can send remotely controlled spacecraft out to learn more about space and Hubble Space Telescope and all that. But I hope we never colonize Mars. I hope we never colonize enough. But after we've trashed this planet, go to some other place and trash that. I hope that just does never happen.
All right. Well, Frank, thank you so much for joining us this evening, and please let us know when the book drops. We'll make sure to let it, publicize it to all of our audience and have you back for a return visit at that time.
Okay, that'd be just fine, Dave, and I really enjoy our conversation, especially because you're so well-informed yourself on this, and I enjoy discussing it with you very much.
Thank you, and if people want to keep up with you and the different projects you're working on, what's the best way to see you?
Well, probably on the Ancient American website, which is just ancientamerican.com. And they've got a little news section on there. It's something completely different, as they used to say on Monty Python.
Right.
That's not as scary because everything is, like you said, safely dead. In archaeology, everything is safely dead, so we can examine things without any consequences, right?
Exactly.
It's a little bit different here.
We'll look forward to talking to you again. Thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
This Labor Day, say goodbye to spills, stains, and overpriced furniture with WashableSofas.com. Featuring Anabay, the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly pricing. Sofas start at just $6.99, making it the perfect time to upgrade your space. Anabay's pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and interchangeable slipcovers are made with high-performance fabric built for real life. You'll love the cloud-like comfort of hypoallergenic, high-resilience foam that never needs fluffing, and a durable steel frame that stands the test of time. With modular pieces, you can rearrange anytime. It's a sofa that adapts to your life. Now through Labor Day, get up to 60% off site-wide at WashableSofas.com. Every order comes with a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping, no restocking fees, every penny back. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.